Today's broadcast was originally recorded on March 10th, 2025.
Elon Musk is spending millions of dollars, you know, on these phony attack ads against me. We need to have a Wisconsin Supreme Court that's working for the people of Wisconsin, not one that is working for Elon Musk.
And so we go back to Wisconsin, eh? Okay.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I'm there.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am... From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Brandcast. As heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, and China Lake, California. Elsewhere in the Golden State, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brand Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from brantblog.com. Now, celebrating 22 years of troublemaking and muckraking with your support. Thank you very much. Welcome to the Brandcast. All right, we will start and finish today with some electoral news, Desi Doyen. Elections, remember those?
Oh, yes, I remember those.
Well, we're back to elections today for a start and a finish. First in Canada, then with our guest, the great John Nichols, up in Wisconsin, where, yes, once again, partisan control of the state Supreme Court is up for grabs in an election just weeks away from today. And yes, Elon Musk is now attempting to buy that election as well. Get to that in a bit. But first, our neighbors even farther north up in Canada elected a new prime minister over the weekend in a show of Liberal Party strength and Canadian nationalism in response to, yep, Donald Trump. Where for months, it looked like Canada's Conservative Party was likely to take back control from Liberals. Well, former central banker Mark Carney will now become Canada's next prime minister after the governing Liberal Party elected him its leader on Sunday as the country deals with the U.S. president's trade war and annexation threats at their federal election looms now in a matter of perhaps days or weeks. The 59-year-old Carney replaces Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who announced his resignation in January, but remains prime minister until his successor is sworn in the coming days. Carney won in a landslide on Sunday among Liberals, winning 85, almost 86% of the vote. As Donald Trump has vowed to enact 25% trade tariffs against our friendly neighbor and longtime ally to the north in 1 month's time, that after reversing himself just one day after tariffs were put in place last week. And as the stock market plummeted, which it did so again, even bigger on Monday, I'm sorry to report. And Donald Trump is still promising trade barriers against steel, aluminum, dairy, and other products and other things even earlier than 1 month. As that's happening, many premiers across many of Canada's provinces have vowed to keep their own trade restrictions in place against the U.S. for now in response. So Americans can expect to see an increase in prices on all of those things in the coming days and weeks unless Trump finally backs down from this madness. But since when has Donald Trump ever backed away from madness? On Sunday night, after winning election, Carney said, quote, Donald Trump, as we know, has put unjustified tariffs on what we build, on what we sell, and how we make a living. He's attacking Canadian families, workers, and businesses, and we cannot let him succeed, and we won't, Carney vowed. He said Canada will keep retaliatory tariffs in place until, quote, the Americans show us respect. We do not have that clip in place.
We're trying to find what happened to
that. It's all right. I can tell you what he said in my best Canadian accent. We didn't ask for this fight. There we go. There we go.
America is not Canada. And Canada never, ever will be part of America in any way, shape, or form. We didn't ask for this fight. We didn't ask for this fight. But Canadians are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. So the Americans, they should make no mistake. In trade, as in hockey, Canada will win.
Now, the opposition Conservatives had been thought to be ready to take down the ruling Liberal Party, at least until Trump appears to have changed the thinking of many Canadians who had hoped to make the election about Trudeau, whose popularity declined as food and housing prices rose and immigration surged following the pandemic. But Trump's trade war and his talk of making Canada the 51st state have infuriated Canadians who are now booing the American anthem at NHL and NBA games, something that would have been unthinkable just months ago. Some are now canceling trips south of the border. Many are avoiding buying American goods when they can. The surge in Canadian nationalism has bolstered the Liberal Party's chances in a parliamentary election, which is now expected within days or weeks, and Liberal showings have been improving steadily in opinion polls. Carney is expected to trigger an election shortly. Either he'll call one or the opposition parties in Parliament could force one with a no-confidence vote later this month. Outgoing Prime Minister Trudeau urged Liberal supporters to get involved, saying, quote, this is a nation-defining moment. Democracy, he said, is not a given. Freedom is not a given. Even Canada, he noted, is not a given. So will the Trump effect, or I guess the anti-Trump effect, as the case may be, will that also play out in elections in this country in about 2 weeks' time, particularly up in Wisconsin? We'll discuss that with John Nichols shortly. Now, longtime listeners may recall that this is the one time of the year. I know I drive Desi Doyen crazy with this. But
with this and much else. But
well, yeah, added to the list, right? But it is the one time that of the year that I try to remember to give credit to, yes, Republicans for the one thing that they did during all 8 years of George W. Bush's presidency that I'm actually happy to give them credit for. And that is extending daylight saving time. So it starts earlier, it ends later, and as it began over the weekend, I am happy to give them credit again now. You're welcome, Republicans. But, to be fair, there actually was something other than extending daylight savings time. Not much, but there was something else that George W. Bush and some Republicans supported and did back during those years that they also do deserve credit for. And that's the creation of PEPFAR. What is PEPFAR? Well, it's the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, an initiative launched in 2003 by then-President George W. Bush, which a lot of Republicans at the time did not support. But the goal was to combat the global HIV/AIDS epidemic, particularly in countries with high infection rates like in sub-Saharan Africa. And in fact, it did eventually get bipartisan support. It has been a huge success, the PEPFAR program, credited with saving the lives of tens of millions of people. with HIV, and it still supplies medicine to about 20 million people, or at least it did until Donald Trump had Elon Musk shut down the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. That was just one of thousands of programs that not only projected American soft power and goodwill around the world, but it also helped to keep Americans back at home safe. But that program, PEPFAR, has now been shut down. And the Trump administration has been, by and large, ignoring court orders to essentially reinstate it, even while claiming that they will or that they already have, even if there is reportedly little evidence on the ground that they have, in fact, done so. So even the few good things that Republicans managed to do over the years, they now seem to be working hard to undermine. They seem to be reversing some of those things for some reason. And this is, that's reportedly already costing lives around the world, even as Trump seems to be carrying out his largest donor's pet project of dismantling the federal government under the guise of curbing waste, fraud, and abuse, despite their inability to show any evidence of any such waste, fraud, or abuse in the bargain. I'm sure there is plenty there. They just are showing no evidence of it. Politics, especially dumb politics, have very real consequences. It's not just politics. It is, in fact, people's lives. And we are beginning to see them lost because of the politics here in the U.S. Similarly, in Ukraine, Donald Trump's recent cutoff of both military aid and, in particular, intelligence and satellite imagery is to our allies fending off Russia's invasion for the past 3 years. That is also now costing very real lives. As Washington Post reported over the weekend, the U.S. has temporarily suspended satellite imagery services to Ukraine, a fresh blow to Kyiv from the Trump administration, which has frozen weapons shipments and intelligence sharing. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency has, quote, temporarily suspended access to the system that provides commercial satellite imagery purchased by the U.S., quote, in accordance with the administration's directive on support to Ukraine. According to the agency in a statement, U.S. partners and allies use the system to access the imagery through its orbital imaging services. U.S. officials said the suspension affected multiple companies that deliver imagery through that program. Ukrainian forces have relied heavily on the service to give a technological edge against Russian forces. Artillery and drone units study the images to assess quality targets, review the damage to refine their attacks. The suspension was immediately felt by soldiers in the Ukrainian military, reportedly, some of whom described the decision as treachery, not politics. I agree. Senior troops have used battle software into which the imagery is integrated, but the maps within the programs are no longer usable, said an officer overseeing intelligence operations inside Russia's Kursk region. That's the one region inside of Russia where Ukraine has finally been able to gain a foothold. And now all the troops holding it are in serious danger because they're blinded. They're blinded by this. Near the eastern city of Pokrovsk, a key logistics hub where Russian forces have waged a bitter campaign, the satellite service simply disappeared, a soldier said. Russia has, in the bargain, reportedly doubled down on their long-range attacks against Ukrainian supply lines leading into Kursk since the intelligence shutdown, which has, as I said, reportedly cost lives of our allies. Or at least of the nation that used to be our ally, until we got Donald Trump. Trump said on Friday that he's also considering imposing, quote, large-scale sanctions on Russia to further compel peace talks. But unlike with the immediate actions he took against Ukraine, right after his ambush of President Zelensky in the Oval Office just over a week ago, Trump's consideration of sanction, his slow, deliberate considerations of sanctions against Russia, Well, that has yet to materialize into any actual new sanctions for some reason. And now, after at least some blowback from fellow Republicans, Trump is pretending that he's going to unfreeze the freeze against Ukraine. But we'll see if that actually comes about or not. The U.S. is, quote, just about ready to lift its freeze on intelligence sharing with Ukraine, Trump said Sunday as American and Ukrainian negotiators prepare for bilateral talks in Saudi Arabia, intended to move toward a peace deal to end Russia's three-year-old invasion. Well, we just about have, was Trump's answer to reporters cryptically on Air Force One, according to ABC News, when he was asked if he would consider resuming intelligence sharing. Quote, we want to do anything we can to get Ukraine serious about getting something done, he added. I guess helping them to die faster is part of that effort. Trump's administration has embarked on a dramatic pivot away from the ironclad backing of Ukraine that was practiced by former President Biden's administration. Trump has falsely blamed Ukraine for starting the war, tried to undermine Zelensky's legitimacy by calling him a dictator, sought to strong-arm Kyiv. And by the way, has anybody heard Donald Trump call Vladimir Putin a dictator lately? Just asking. An actual dictator, you know. He sought to strong-arm Kyiv into a controversial minerals sharing deal. He froze military aid and intel support in a bid to force Ukraine into making concessions to Russia. What has he forced Russia to concede to Ukraine? As far as anyone could tell, so far, nothing at all. At least upcoming peace talks in Saudi Arabia this week will reportedly include not just the U.S. and Russia, but even representatives from Ukraine, if you can believe such a thing. They will now be allowed to take part in negotiations to end Russia's three-year-old assault on their sovereign neighbor. So thoughtful, right?
Sure. And I wonder if, you know, maybe Trump might decide, or the Trump administration might decide, to actually ask Putin to withdraw from Ukraine.
Well,
because that would
that's
end the
asking
war
a lot.
Immediately.
That's it. Yeah. Well, you mean they could just leave and the war would be over?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The public U.S.-Ukraine break has prompted concern among European leaders, with leaders rallying around Zelensky, especially after that Oval Office debacle. Officials in Russia, meanwhile, were jubilant as Trump has seemingly flipped sides in the conflict with Russia, openly suggesting that the Trump administration had aligned its views with the Kremlin. And further underscoring our show late last week, in which we looked at the evidence that Trump, the president of the United States, for whatever reason you may decide to look at, is now serving as little more than a Russian asset at this point. If you missed that show, you can, of course, download that for free anytime at bradblog.com. And in further blowback from the public against the Trump administration dismantling both our foreign and domestic policies and programs, well, some good news amid very bad news for investors in the stock market today, with the Dow dropping nearly 900 points on Monday and the Nasdaq falling about 4% after its worst couple of weeks in years on the heels of Trump's trade wars and, well, everything else. You might be happy to learn, amid that at least, that Donald Trump's money-losing social media venture called Trump Media went over a cliff on Monday as well, beyond what the broader market did, dropping nearly 11.5% on Monday. But the news for his co-president, Elon Musk, was even worse, with Tesla, the company that made Musk the world's richest man, tumbling almost 15.5% in a single day on Monday. Musk's company has lost almost 50% of its value since he went full bore into far-right politics on behalf of Donald Trump and other far-right political parties around the world. 50%. That equates to hundreds of billions of dollars. The blowback to Musk and his company has not just come via the stock market, as protests at Tesla dealerships are now becoming a regular sight. And as Washington Post reported over the weekend, some of that pushback against Musk and Tesla has, in fact, turned violent, at least as directed toward property, if not people. Since President Donald Trump's inauguration, the paper reports more than a dozen violent or destructive acts have been directed at Tesla facilities. That, according to court documents, surveillance photographs, police records, and local media reports reviewed by the Washington Post. The incidents come as Elon Musk has rocketed to prominence as Trump's best-known backer and as a right-wing provocateur in his own right. The ire directed at the tech billionaire online has increasingly spilled into real life, with vandalism directed at Tesla storefronts now, as well as charging stations and vehicles. In March, for example, several Tesla superchargers at a shopping center in Littleton, Massachusetts, were set on fire. Vandals in Maryland also spray-painted "No Musk" onto a Tesla building, along with a swastika-like symbol. In February, a man brandishing an AR-style semi-automatic weapon fired at a Tesla storefront in Salem, Oregon. Nobody was hurt, I believe. I believe it was before opening hours. But just a few weeks earlier, investigators say the same man attacked the same dealership by throwing Molotov cocktails at Tesla vehicles and through the store window. That, according to court documents. The destruction adds to the woes of a car maker already in turmoil. So if you are an investor in Tesla, well, sorry. Its stock has now fallen by more than, as Washington Post reported over the weekend, more than 35% since Trump's inauguration. But you can go ahead and add another 15% to that on Monday. So, as I said, lost about half of its value, and last year the company suffered its first annual sales drop in more than a decade. Wonder why. In Germany, Tesla car sales plummeted by 76% in February compared with a year earlier, according to figures released last Wednesday. We previously reported on sales dropping by about 50% elsewhere in Europe for Tesla, even while the EV market has gone up about 40% over that same time. So it's not people turning against EVs, it's people turning against Elon Musk's EVs and his company. Some owners have expressed buyer's remorse over owning a car that some now see as a symbol of far-right politics, which is a stark departure from the environmental consciousness it once epitomized. Now, the question is, will that anger against Elon Musk and Donald Trump translate into votes for his political opponents, like the Supreme Court election in Wisconsin, where Musk's political action committee is now spending big to defeat the candidate supported by the state's Democratic Party? We will discuss that question next and much more related to it with our friend John Nichols of The Nation. After a quick break, I'm Brad Friedman. And you are listening to The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, excuse me, we have for years on this program, and I mean years, probably decades at this point, we've devoted an exorbitant amount of time to judicial, specifically Supreme Court elections in the great state of Wisconsin, as the state had been sort of an early petri dish of sorts for the GOP gangster-style democracy, if that word is even appropriate at this point anymore, that we have since seen spread to other states and now to the federal government in the ensuing years, just as we had been warning for years that was likely to happen, when it only seemed to be, for a time, the state of Wisconsin going off the rails. under the control of then governor and pretend tough guy Scott Walker, the state GOP was able to adopt wildly gerrymandered congressional and state legislative districts to keep the Republican Party in power for years. Despite the growing unpopularity of their political programs and their positions, and with Walker in power in the governor's office and the ability to appoint still more right-wing activists to vacant state Supreme Court seats, they were also able to gain and keep control of what became a wildly activist, far-right Republican state Supreme Court, reliably backing up the governor's and the gerrymandered state legislature's moves to the far radical right in an otherwise closely divided, largely purple state. Now, it took years, but eventually voters were able to sort of claw their way out of much of the GOP takeover of all three branches of government in the state, with Democrats winning back every statewide elected office, from governor to lieutenant governor to attorney general to secretary of state, state treasurer. But the greatest prize for state Democrats might have been when they finally wrested control of the state's high court from Republicans. Wisconsin's state Supreme Court elections are supposedly nonpartisan, but the two parties, well, they know which candidates are liberal and supposedly conservative, and they put a lot of resources into getting their preferred candidates elected when seats come up for retention elections after they first may have been filled by the state governor. In April of 2023, for the first time in about 15 years, with the election of Judge Janet Protasiewicz, the court's ideological balance finally shifted back to a 4-3, narrow but 4-3 liberal majority, allowing the court, with a Democrat in the governor's mansion, to overturn many of the most extreme Republican policies, or at least begin doing so, from the previous decades, from gerrymandering to the state legislature, giving Democrats a shot at winning back control of the state's House and Senate, to unwinding Scott Walker's landmark stripping of union rights, to abortion restrictions, to whether or not voters may cast their absentee ballots in drop boxes or not. But in April last year, the court's senior member and longtime stalwart liberal state Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley announced her retirement from the court. That'll take effect at the end of July this year. Yes, putting partisan control up for grabs yet again on the very closely divided court after years of ferociously contested, closely watched, expensively waged, and sometimes questionably tallied Supreme Court battles in the Badger State. That election will now be held, no fooling, on April 1st. Yes, April Fool's Day. And early in-person voting begins on March 18 across many areas of Wisconsin, with absentee voting, I believe, already underway. Running to replace the retiring liberal justice is liberal Dane County Circuit Court Judge Susan Crawford, described by The Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent, and not coincidentally, Wisconsin native son John Nichols, as being backed by Bradley and dozens of current and former jurists and court commissioners from across Wisconsin. She is running against former Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel, who Nichols characterizes as a right-wing ally of former Governor Scott Walker, who was appointed to a Waukesha County judgeship after being defeated in his 2018 re-election bid for the AG post. So, another brutal Wisconsin Supreme Court election with huge consequences for the state and the nation, which tends to follow in the footsteps of Wisconsin over the years. Well, that election is now underway, but with an additional twist. The world's richest man, who essentially purchased the presidency for a pretty cool $250 million, and the U.S. federal government along with it last year, that would be Elon Musk, is, as Nichols describes it, trying to buy another election, this time in Wisconsin with one of his political action committees called Building America's Future, reportedly buying more than $1.5 million in TV ads across the state late last month, further bastardizing an American democracy that has been, perhaps irretrievably, we'll see, poisoned by millionaires, billionaires, and out-of-control corporate spending on the electoral process, even those of what might otherwise nationally be little-noticed elections for, you know, things like control of the state Supreme Court. Said Susan Crawford's spokesperson about the entry of Musk into the state race, quote, in D.C., Elon Musk has taken control of Americans' private financial information and cut funding for hungry kids. Now, Musk is trying to buy off Brad Schimmel, the Republican, or, yeah, he's a Republican, and take over control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court so that Schimmel can rubber stamp an extreme agenda of banning abortion and cozying up to corporations. Joining us now is the great John Nichols of The Nation. He is also associate editor of his local Madison, Wisconsin's Capital Times and the author of too many books on progressive politics to list them all here. But his latest is titled, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-written with some dude named Bernie Sanders. Oh, John Nichols, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
I am glad to be with you, Brad. What a pleasure.
Glad to have you here, as always. I'm having, if you can turn him up a little bit, Wendell, having trouble hearing him. John, you just get closer to the mic if needed. I've tried to sort of set up there we go. That sounds better. I've tried to kind of set up the basics of what we're looking at in this upcoming election, but feel free to correct me on anything I got wrong. But beyond that, kind of wanted to leave it up to you to explain what is actually, literally, practically at stake in this particular Wisconsin Supreme Court election to fill a 10-year seat on the state's high court.
Well, Brad, as you well know, the answer to your question is pretty much everything.
I see.
That's all. When we're picking Supreme Court justices in Wisconsin, you're filling places on a very, very powerful court in a very closely divided state. So at the end of the day, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is usually the body that settles out all kinds of issues, everything from abortion rights to voting rights to labor rights. And even now, you know, I know this may seem a bit of a stretch to folks who haven't been following Wisconsin politics, but I tell you, this is the case. Whether Wisconsin respects the results of presidential elections. Mm-hmm. In 2016 and 2020, Wisconsin had incredibly close results, around 20,000-25,000 votes in the presidential race. And in each case, you had an immense amount of litigation related to the process. In 2020, the Supreme Court ultimately ended up with a case that decided essentially how the challenges to the Wisconsin results would go forward. The court, by a 4-3 margin, with one kind of marginal Republican conservative going over with the liberals, which was a good thing in this case, to essentially respect the will of the voters. Had the court gone the other way, might have had the biggest legal victory for Donald Trump's big lie in the country. So that's a short summary of what's at stake.
Oh, that's all. That's all. Okay.
That's all.
I want to get back to the electoral chicanery that is at stake. But the New York Times reported that as Attorney General Brad Schimmel sought to curtail abortion rights in the state, the Times added that Schimmel said at an event last summer that he is fine with the state's 1849 ban on abortion, telling supporters, quote, what is flawed about that law? That's what he said. So,
I know.
What is flawed with that law? What would that ban, what would that ban actually do if it was allowed to be enacted in Wisconsin?
You know, that ban is from a time when there were still folks who entertained the idea that leeching would be an effective medical treatment.
Oh, don't give Bobby Kennedy any ideas, but continue.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm telling you is it is a ban rooted in a time when, you know, pretty much everything we thought about, not just women's rights, but about medicine was very, very different. And it was written in a very draconian way that certainly made it within the realm of possibility that issues that we think of as should, you know, even for people who are maybe anti-choice, should be up for grabs. Things like the life of the mother, things like, you know, rape, incest, all of that, you know, potentially put aside by this 1849 law. Remarkably, Brad, it's a law that was written even before there was a Republican Party.
Really?
Right?
Right. Yeah, yeah, you're right. 1849. Yeah. Yeah, good point.
So, I mean, it's so far out of sync. Yeah. If you wanted to pass an anti-abortion law, right, you could sit down and write one.
Mm-hmm.
That's within the realm of reason. States have done it. But in this case, what the real militant foes of abortion rights want is to have this 1849 law on the book, because it's amorphous enough, but yet draconian enough that they could pretty much do whatever they want.
Now, could the court, could the current courts, fairer, largely ungerrymandered state legislative maps that were a long time coming, could they be re-gerrymandered by a right-wing majority on the high court if Schimmel wins?
Only unlikely unless you get a Republican governor with a Republican legislature.
Okay.
You know, within reason, because the legislature got the Republicans in the legislature got scared that the court was going to draw new maps.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bent to Governor Evers's proposal. You know, so this effectively the court let go of jurisdiction and let it go back to the legislature. There was a quote-unquote bipartisan compromise that got better maps put in place. The reason that happened, Brad, is just an interesting asterisk here, and that is that if the court had redrawn the maps by a legitimate legal standard, they probably would have been even more sympathetic to the Democrats.
Yeah, yeah. And unlike with something like the 1849 ban, with the if they wanted to re-gerrymander the maps, you'd have to get the approval of the governor and all that. But the 1849 ban, in theory, is still in place if you can get a court case to have the Supreme Court say, yeah, that's the law of the land. And it doesn't require Tony Evers to sign anything, correct?
No, yeah, that's the concern, of course. And even with the gerrymandering... We're, you know, when I'm answering your questions, I'm kind of operating within the realm of reality, right?
What?
Yeah, I know it's crazy.
Yeah.
But we don't know what would happen if Brad Schimmel, who is really a militant judicial activist, if he got on this court, you know, could even things, even the basic standards of how separation of powers have operated, could they get torn up? It's within the realm of reason. And the one thing that we know, though, Brad, of the issues that you're bringing up is on the issue of labor rights. It's very important to note that Wisconsin led the country in tearing down labor rights under Scott Walker. It upended public employee bargaining rights, and then it passed a right to work law. A lot of these things were done in ways that were inappropriate legally. They didn't respect, for instance, the concept of universality, i.e. that if you're passing a law that requires unions to do things, you can't separate out certain unions.
Right.
In Wisconsin, they separated out police and fire and some bus drivers.
Right.
And
because
so,
they supported Scott Walker at the time.
Well, the police and fire. Yeah. And so the end result is that, that those cases that tore up labor rights in Wisconsin, and in fact, set the model for the country, were, you know, essentially, you know, approved by the court. And this court could have easily back in 2011, 2012, 2014, you know, upended these initiatives and said, that's wrong. You know, you shouldn't have done that. But they didn't. And if you got a conservative court with Schimmel on it, you would probably have a court not just that would uphold the anti-labor laws, but perhaps be one of the most militant anti-labor courts in the country. And this is in a historic industrial and historically heavily unionized state. And here's the kicker on the thing. One of the justices on the current court helped to write the anti-labor laws when Walker was governor. And another justice, Schimmel, or potential justice if he were to be elected, led the defense of many of those initiatives as attorney general. So you'd have just a court that is sort of uniquely anti-labor, yeah, and might even set the standard for the country on anti-labor initiatives.
Was that Rebecca Bradley, the one who helped write that?
No, it wasn't. Rebecca Bradley was, she comes out of a legal, you know, another right-wing legal zone.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, there's another justice on the court who is a moderate, supposedly a moderate Republican, who was actually at one time Scott Walker's counsel.
Ah, okay. It's a blizzard of Bradleys, John, between Rebecca Bradley and Ann Walsh Bradley, who's retiring. Rebecca Bradley is a Republican. Brad Schimmel, who's running.
And Brad on the radio.
This is the Bradcast, after all, so it has to be expected. But John Nichols, Elon Musk tweeted earlier this year that it is, quote, very important to vote Republican for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to prevent voting fraud. Now, even though the state Supreme Court candidates run on a nonpartisan ballot, so one can't vote Republican per se, as Elon was asking, but, you know, everybody sort of knows who's being supported by the Republican, who's being supported by the Democrat. But what does he mean by voting, presumably for Schimmel, quote, to prevent voting fraud? What does that mean?
Well, what it means is getting somebody on the court who would put their thumb on the scale as a right-wing judicial activist in favor of initiatives that have sought to make it hard for people to vote. Draconian voter ID laws, mm-hmm, restrictions on souls to the polls and other initiatives that have predominantly been used in the African-American community. Laws that make it harder for students to vote by not allowing them to use their student ID for identification, things like that. We've had a lot of it.
Yeah.
But at the heart of it, again, you get back to that gerrymandering issue as well. So, yeah, there's just a pile of things. Wisconsin, here's the deal about Wisconsin, Brad. Wisconsin is a very divided state, but it's marginally on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. And so the way that Republicans, keep themselves competitive in Wisconsin is by being on kind of a constant mobilization to make it harder to vote, mm-hmm, make it harder to vote for people who might vote Democratic, mm-hmm, I would say.
Yeah.
So that's what Elon Musk means. Although I'm not even sure Elon Musk knows.
No, he doesn't.
That's what he means.
No, he doesn't know. He has no idea what he's. Somebody told him.
Somebody's telling him.
Yeah.
And that's why he said vote Republican. It's fine if his followers decide to go into the ballot box and look for the Republican line on the ballot. That's fine. They're not going to find it.
Right.
But that sort of sums up the situation with Musk. I don't think he knows anything about Wisconsin. I don't think he even cares about Wisconsin. You know, what someone told him was that this Wisconsin Supreme Court race is, you know, a critical juncture in our politics, and he should come in on the Republican / Trump side.
Right.
And you know what? Whoever told him that was right. They were right. It is a critical juncture. If this race is decided for Susan Crawford, the rule of law progressive candidate, it will be the first major pushback against not just Trumpism and, you know, what we saw last November as regards to election results, but also against Musk's entry into politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it is a really critical juncture, and one that, you know, even now you're always ahead of the curve. This is only heating up. I can tell you that barring some horror that we can't even imagine, when this race is decided on April 1 into April 2, it'll be the lead story in the New York Times. It'll be the lead story on the evening news. It's going to be huge because of everything that's being thrown into it. And, I have very little doubt that things could shift, but I have very little doubt that it's possible that Donald Trump and Elon Musk will be in the state rallying their backers.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if after all, Wisconsin went to Donald Trump just a few months ago. And I'm wondering, has Elon Musk himself now become well known enough and broadly enough hated in response that actually his entry into the race on behalf of the so-called conservative candidate might actually do more harm than good by, you know, motivating the state's liberals against Musk's candidate Schimmel here. Are you seeing any signs of that on the ground?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Musk is much discussed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in now even in advertising, and it's not advertising from the Republicans saying Elon Musk endorses Brad Schimmel. It's advertising from progressives who are saying, look, this is the threat we face.
Mm.
It's being brought up at political events all over. This is a real factor. And Brad, because your listeners are so savvy and because you are, you'll recognize that Musk already has a track record of potentially damaging the candidates he endorses. Mm-hmm. It's just that it isn't from the United States, it's from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good deal of evidence that when Musk and J.D. Vance came out big for the AfD, the far-right party in Germany,
right,
before their election last month, that the AfD numbers were much weaker than expected. They underperformed
mm-hmm.
in the election. And I've talked to German analysts who've said, yeah, one of the factors in that was that the AfD became too associated with Vance, Musk, and what's happening mm-hmm. in the U.S.
Mm. And I think we saw a little bit of that over the weekend, this past weekend. I was talking about in the previous segment up in Canada.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's changed the politics of Canada. Right?
These guys are poison, it seems to me, you know, at the ballot box. We'll see if that continues, because according to a Wisconsin public radio, John Nichols, despite the importance of this election, many voters say they still do not know enough about either of the candidates to make a decision. Quote, among registered voters surveyed, 29% had a favorable opinion of Schimmel, 32% unfavorable, but 38% said they didn't know enough about him, didn't know which way to vote one way or another. But Crawford is running her first statewide campaign. Now, Schimmel has been on the ballot statewide two different times, yet there's still 38% don't know enough. Crawford, she's running her first statewide campaign, has lower recognition among voters with just 19% favorable, 23% unfavorable, but a whopping 58% saying they don't have enough information. These were numbers from just last week, with early voting beginning next week, John, suggesting to me at least that blanketing the airwaves between now and Election Day, as Musk's group seems to be doing, could make or break either of these candidates, no?
No, you're right, but it's not just Musk. I mean, I think it's very, very important to understand. Musk is still a mid-level donor mm-hmm. in this race.
Okay, fair. Know? Yeah, yeah.
The billionaire class is all in for Schimmel.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people writing checks, a lot of very, very wealthy people, not just from in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. but from outside Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
because of the simple reality, you're covering it, that these Wisconsin Supreme Court races are pivotal contests, not just for the state, but really in defining a lot of the direction of American jurisprudence and also politics. And so I expect that this race will, when all is said and done, I'll conservatively suggest in the range of 50 million. It could well be substantially more than that. I think there'll be wall-to-wall TV ads, wall to wall, you know, your mailbox full with mailings,
mm-hmm.
Huge teams of people out knocking doors all over the state. We will end up in Wisconsin with everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but with a real lot of people knowing who both Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel are, and
and Elon Musk.
They know Elon,
right?
I think they know him now already.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at the end of the day, with a maybe not a presidential level turnout, but a very, very high turnout, I expect we're going to get there. Now, that means that Musk becomes in some ways even a bigger factor. Yes, his money is influential. Money in politics is influential.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the very, very high level of you know, anger at him,
mm-hmm.
I think he becomes a burden for Schimmel.
Right.
I mean, look, this is a guy who is mocked weekly in the opening segment of Saturday Night Live.
Right. And so you put them up in ads. I mean, and I haven't seen them yet, but I suspect they're going to be Brad Schimmel and Elon Musk and maybe Donald Trump, maybe not even Donald Trump, might just be Schimmel and Musk pairing them together.
Yeah.
Almost in one sense, if Musk was not willing to bury this election with money the way he did with the presidential election, he might have been even smarter just staying out of it entirely because it's become nationalized, or at least it seems like it will. Between now and election day,
I think it will. I think it is already in many senses. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing: Schimmel encouraged this.
Yeah.
So Schimmel wanted this. There is evidence that at events, he's talked up Musk. He certainly talked up Trump. And so in a sense, Schimmel was inviting this. And I think the reason for that is because Wisconsin has developed a pattern in recent Supreme Court elections of voting for women jurists to put on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. It's the Democrats won in 2018. They won in 2020. They won in 2023. In each case, a reasonably progressive woman ran who had judicial experience and who talked about wanting to make sure that the court was, treated women and workers and voters in a fair and reasonable way. So there's good evidence that Wisconsin has patterned toward a circumstance where a more progressive candidate, especially a woman, can get elected. I think that the Republicans wanted Musk's money in this race, mm-hmm. as well as other billionaires' money in this race, because they do feel they have a bit of a hill to climb.
I'm wondering, I've got just a few minutes with John Nichols here, but I'm wondering, with all of the attention that has been on Donald Trump and what's going on in D.C. and all the, firing of federal workers, shutdown of programs and so forth, if A, the election is getting the attention that it deserves in Wisconsin that it might have otherwise received nationally even by now, and in previous Wisconsin Supreme Court elections, all elections really in Wisconsin, organizers have gone all out to raise awareness among college-age voters. Are you seeing the same level of effort to alert Wisconsinites that this election is coming in 2 weeks or so, just over 2 weeks away at this point, I think?
Yeah, I think you're asking a very important question here, Brad, because my sense is that after the 2024 election, a lot of people, especially a lot of progressives, were sort of overwhelmed. Right. Mm-hmm. There was a sense that, they were, many were shocked by the result. Mm-hmm. If they weren't shocked by the result, they were deeply disappointed. I think a lot of people kind of, went to ground. They stepped back.
Yep.
For a moment. And I do think that's a factor, and it has been a factor in this race. Yes. The news has been overwhelmingly national as opposed to in state. Mm-hmm. But as we kind of move toward the election, my sense is that two things are happening. One, there is a growing, and I think you've seen it, you've talked about it. There's a growing resistance to Trump and Musk nationally. We're seeing larger demonstrations, protests, folks coming to town hall meetings, all of these things happening. And so I do think that those progressives who were kind of standing down or standing back are back in the game. Right. They're more present politically and ready to, ready to be heard. So okay. I do think there's an element of that. And then I also do believe, and again, I'm not a fan of this, but money in politics does make races big deals.
Yeah.
And so I do believe that the immense level of spending and on television, on mail and everything else will probably, as we get toward April 1, make this a high turnout race.
And is a high turnout race good for Republicans or good for Democrats at this point in the Badger State?
Well, of course, as you well know, that's where people turn out.
We've had high turnout races before, in the presidential recently, back in some of Scott Walker's elections that Democrats were sure they had because they saw big turnout, didn't work out in their favor.
That is a very, very good point. There's a subtlety here. One of the evidences that we've seen, we don't know it for sure because we've got to see a lot more races,
yep.
But is that Trump voters turn out for Trump. They don't necessarily turn out for down ballot contests. Mm-hmm. And so there may be some slippage in Trump turnout. Certainly that's, or in Republican leaning turnout. That's something that conservatives are very concerned about. In Wisconsin, on the progressive side, I think one of the concerns is that there was a shakiness in the student vote in 2024. You saw a number of young men vote for Trump.
Yeah.
And then there was also just some underperformance in some other areas. That is obviously a concern, and that's something that, that folks are trying to shore up. One other subtlety of this is the issue of abortion rights, which played in a very, very big way in the 2023 race for Supreme Court, is still incredibly significant and very much in play. But there's always this question of whether it will continue to resonate at the same level. And where that becomes a big deal is in the suburban areas around Milwaukee, which have historically been huge Republican vote generating areas.
Yeah.
If abortion rights is you know, genuinely as vibrant and resonant an issue as it was in 2022 to 2023, then you're going to see a shift among at least some voters there. And if that happens, if you see a better performance for Susan Crawford in those suburban counties, then Schimmel will lose.
And that will certainly be a bellwether moving into next year and congressional elections. And by the way, we've got Virginia elections between now and next year.
And
we've got New Jersey and a couple of special elections down in Florida. We'll have reason to be giving you a shout, John, even if it's for this Supreme Court election in Wisconsin, no matter how it turns out. John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive, associate editor of his local Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times, and the author of It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism with one Senator Bernie Sanders. You can also find John on both the Twitters and, more importantly, the Blue Skies at Nichols Uprising and, of course, at thenation.com. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Brad. It's been great to be with you.
As ever. Great with you. All right. We got to get out. That's it. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to our engineer, Wendell, the handyman Handy. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who support our work. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, particularly Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.